Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to Robots and Red Tape. As always, I'm your host, Nick Schutt. Happy to have my friend, Dr. Harry Monroe, with me here today. Harry, how are you?
Hey, doing well, Nick.
Awesome, man. Really appreciate it. Really fascinating topic that we're having a conversation around. Going to really talk all about the power grid and how it's set up, why it's set up the way it is, and is it set up in a way that's going to meet our energy needs moving forward, especially as you look at data centers continuing to grow to support all of the AI work, the AI projects and AI work, and then, just actual life as well. So Harry, for folks that don't have the opportunity to know you yet, you mind telling everybody just a little bit about yourself, your background, who you are and how you got here, man?
Sure. Yeah. So I work at IBM. I've got my IBM shirt on here. I also have degrees. I got my bachelor's in science and engineering from Columbia University in operations research, engineering management systems, and my master's of public health from Johns Hopkins. I have a background in healthcare, and I should add, I'm not a doctor,
Oh, I'm sorry.
but
My
That's okay.
apologies. I'm trying to give you extra titles, Harry.
Master Harry Networks. And so I have a background mostly in healthcare, and did a lot of work with at IBM with healthcare consulting, technology integrations, and that industry is fascinating to me. But as any technology person, I'm interested in the latest trends, including around artificial intelligence, as you focus on in this podcast, and I'm just seeing that the massive energy requirements to power these AI data centers that are popping up all over the place, and the changes that are already the stresses that are already happening to our energy grid. As we try to move into more renewables and make this green transition that we've been talking about for decades, it's just getting harder with all the extra strain, all the extra demand that we're seeing. So a lot of my most of my projects and research that I'm doing these days is trying to learn as much as I can about this stuff, how the grid works, how and what new kinds of energy we're trying to bring on, and how we can reconcile all of that. I'm not an expert by any means, but I'm looking forward to our discussion about this and seeing the kinds of things we can talk about.
Absolutely, man. And just you are also a quantum ambassador at IBM, is that correct?
I am.
Yeah, so you can also you're one of the few people that can explain quantum to a layperson and make it make sense. Is that right?
Yeah, totally. So we can cover that as well.
Awesome.
And some of the coolest applications of quantum computing are in the energy materials areas. So thinking about new kinds of solar panels, new kinds of battery design, some of the best uses of quantum. So if we want to do a short explainer on quantum computing, we can do that as well during our time here.
Yeah, man, love to do that as well, because I, and as we talk about it, especially as it relates to the power grid, and I've wanted to do an episode around this for a while, ever since, I think about a year ago, I'm sure you saw Microsoft cut a deal to reopen the Three Rivers nuclear power plant, and buy 100% of the electricity coming out of it for 10 years to power data centers specifically. And when people are doing, work operating and working at that scale, like that speaks to the demand around power. And especially as you look at the demand as it's going to continue to grow and increase. So for folks that don't know, including myself, Harry, how is the power grid actually set up in this country?
Sure. So it's been a long time coming. We start out with small regional build outs and have spread across the country. I should say that the grid is a bit of a misnomer. It's actually three separate power grids powering the US. One kind of it's basically west of the Rockies, east of the Rockies, and then Texas is their totally their own grid. Also called ERCOT. And in each of these grids, has some ability to communicate, but it's pretty fragmented, and we're dealing with some pretty old infrastructure as well. A lot of the build out was between 40 and 60 years ago, and we have some big modernization challenges. So you can think of it a little bit put together with popsicles and spit. And so it has to be very, very, everything is coming by the millisecond to meet the demands of the power grid. And it's a wonder that we don't have more blackouts given the sensitive nature of all this.
Absolutely. And so is and I mean it makes sense that it is patchwork and piecemeal, because I know that like we were the first country to really invest in electrical energy and power generation, going back to like the Niagara Falls power plant, which is super cool, and the whole story around like direct current versus alternating current and who won that race, which is obviously alternating current did. But it makes sense that it would have grown in a more of a patchwork way as opposed to like an overall top-down architected approach. And why, but also why is it so crucial for energy supply and energy demand to always meet?
Sure. So to talk about this, we need to think a little bit about the electrons and how they actually move around. So there's very little. Sometimes people think about electricity flowing through the grid. It's not that much like water. You basically have there's the little game with the desk ornaments with like the balls that go like this. You can basically think of all the electrons in a wire as many little balls like that. So when you take a ball off to, charge your laptop or power your electric razor, your fridge, or whatever, you take a ball off, and then you need a ball to enter the wire from the other side. So that's matching one to one with another electron or set of electrons being generated, being stripped off of some sort of material or generated in some way from the other side, from the power plant. And it doesn't really matter if it's from natural gas or from solar or other renewables, coal. You're just getting an electron coming off of that. So you have basically immediate 100% matching of electrons being used and electrons being generated at any time. So it's this very difficult balance. It's like all these spinning plates that need to stay totally balanced. You can have a slight amount of flexing. Right now, the grid operates at about 60 hertz, the frequency. And if you get outside of that, you can cause issues like blackouts, right? Basically, a blackout is if you are requesting an electron and it's not there, right? So if you have even just small changes in this, even like a 1/5 of a hertz deviation, so 60, if you get up to 60.2 hertz, then you can have start to experience some difficulties. This is just a very sensitive matching process to get all the electrons from where they're going to where they're being used, and then returning it back in a big loop.
So it's all just like a giant balancing game to try to balance the right number of to balance the right amount of generation to match usage. And if you don't do that, like things start to break.
Totally. And you can see how, and it's easier to imagine if you think about the gradual ramp up over time. So, as we've had years and decades of understanding what the general trends of energy consumption are, you can have the power plants kind of meet that. And there are all these different electricity markets, to compensate the electricity providers. but so they can pretty well forecast what the demand is and try to meet that supply exactly. But it's a lot easier to meet that supply with our firm our dispatchable resources, like with a coal power plant or a natural gas power plant, than with these renewables. Like when you have sun or wind, and the wind is blowing harder than you expect it to, then you can get way more energy than you wanted, and you need to kind of cap that. Or if you're getting great sun, and then a cloud comes over your solar field, then all of a sudden, wow, you're making a lot less energy than you wanted to. So adding renewables has made for a big challenge in ensuring that supply demand matching at every given point in time.
Absolutely. And it's wild to me that it's all generated in real time first. That in and of itself is kind of crazy, and this level of balance that we need. And also, like as you mentioned, 40 to 60-year-old infrastructure. And then obviously considering that we're getting hit with storms constantly and wind, and then like I mean, you look at the hurricane that hurricanes and things like that, where that can also create additional, let's just say, hiccups in other ways. I think like breaking wires is not the kind of blackout we're talking about here. We're talking about, blackouts caused by, lack of generation or too much generation. How does having our infrastructure be so old and so patchwork make this even more difficult?
Sure. So because it's so old, a lot of these transmission lines and transformers are near the end of life. They're just more fragile, and more likely to have outages, fire hazards, things like that. This fragility that it has just increases and exacerbates the problem with potential for blackouts or other issues for getting supply to where it's needed.
Absolutely. And
So,
go ahead.
yeah, and the modernization gap, so it was something like we need to invest something like $2 trillion over the next 30 years or so to get everything caught up.
Wow, that's a lot of money, and that's a big investment that needs to be made. And so are and can you explain what is a traditional grid and what is like versus a smart grid, and kind of where are we in that transition process?
Sure. So traditional grids, what we've had for a long time. We just do our best to meet that supply and demand. A lot of the energy is being measured by people running these operators, and they're literally in operating rooms. You can imagine like producing with like producing a TV show or something, right? So the big screen's up showing demand at every given time and trying their best to all right, like call that power plant. We got to turn up the burning rate or whatever, change the rate of generation. And using a smart grid, we can improve a lot of this. We basically a smart grid is it's adding IoT, the Internet of Things, to the grid instead of our homes or whatever. So instead of having a smart TV or a smart fridge, you have your smart power lines, right? And smart sensors along the grid. So most of that is digital sensors, automation, analytics, on top of the traditional infrastructure. So you can understand how different lines are performing, figure out when you need to do some predictive maintenance, things like that. Make sure that you can see when there could be an anomaly in a certain power line, figure out how you can optimize flow, maybe take away a little bit of the pressure from those operators. and help them automatically change the rate of production to match demand. So some things like that.
So a lot of it is like automation around information and gathering data, right? Yeah, I mean, obviously, as we all know and talk about constantly, that AI runs on data, and now we're essentially installing like SCADA systems, so like supervisor control and data acquisition systems with PLCs on these different places, so you can see the power. Because, like, I would assume that there's like multiple ways that you can get power from where it's generated to, like, larger distribution centers, right? And so moving that flow to optimize it from an efficiency perspective is now done manually. Is that correct? Or
Right.
sometimes
Well,
manually?
it's, I mean, it's often it's the flowing, the moving of those electrons through the wires they pretty much go wherever the voltage wants them to go, you know? So in the same way that when lightning strikes, it'll strike whatever the way is to get it fastest to the ground. That the same thing is happening with the electrons produced at any one of these power plants. It's going somewhere as quickly as it can. So that is happening automatically. We're not dictating which electrons go where. But if we had better forecasting abilities, then we would be able to predict generation and be able to determine generation more easily, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. And so how do the grid operators that you mentioned like secure like ensure the stability of the grid and also security, right? And how is the grid secured?
This is a big concern, right? So I think you've had other people on talking about operations, OT, right? The critical infrastructure and how that all gets secured. Some of these the more things that are on the internet, the more exposure that you have, the more surface area for attack from a rogue actor. So I know with a lot of like other utilities that are like just a water plant or different things like this, they're adding a lot of IoT to them, connecting them to the internet and saying, oh, that's so great, but it's actually makes them more vulnerable to attack. Whereas if you're literally changing and adjusting the balance of chemicals by hand, then that prevent pre it pr provides a bit of a physical security risk, but that's a lot easier to protect against sometimes than the cybersecurity risk. And some localities are going to some very archaic or natural methods to balance these things. I think just staying in the critical infrastructure, non-electricity for one more minute. I believe in, I think it's Warsaw, Poland, somewhere in Poland. They're literally using clams or some sort of bivalve. You have clams, mollusks, oysters, something like that, to assess the health of their water system. So if too many of the clams close and say, nope, I'm done, you know, I think they're oysters actually. Oysters are great at processing water. They can process through any oyster can process like 50 gallons of water a day, whereas in an hour, very high throughput. But at some point, even they don't want to be there. Don't want to be breathing that water, and they'll close. And if too many of these close, then you say, oh, nope, the water's not clean. So the more we can rely on the lower tech possibilities, the better. And the same thing we want to do as much as possible with grid operators, right? So like you said, a lot of them use the SCADA systems, trying to use markets to balance electricity and stuff like that. They're all doing the same kinds of cybersecurity measures that any organization is trying to implement to prevent our grid going down. And but you know, a lot of electricity, it's not a high margin business. So it's funny that a lot of the critical infrastructure is the stuff that's lowest margin. If you think about, wastewater treatment, electricity, and like hospitals and other kinds of things like this, all this critical infrastructure is, it's not like the high margin innovative stuff like new electronics and things like that. So all these organizations don't have that much in the way of resources to invest in these things, and they're some of the most vulnerable. So it's an unfortunate mismatch there.
And it's also the structure on which our modern society runs. You can't have NVIDIA, which is like very high margin, right? You can't have you can't have them making all these. You can't have them running data centers and selling their chips into data centers, because none of that would exist without electricity, right? At all. And thinking about like data centers specifically, how much power do they use, right? And how does that like, and what are some good comparisons of, so folks can actually understand the amount of energy that is consumed?
Sure. So these when we talk about energy use, the scales can vary a lot. So it's we that's why we use and the same thing with computer storage. We use the these SI units for converting by orders of magnitude. So we talk about kilowatts, or a watt is right, one unit of production. That's 1 watt is 1 joule per second. We need to just think about some of these physics units. That's a base unit of power, right? But we almost never think about just watts. We think about kilowatts, which is 1,000 watts, megawatts, 1,000 kilowatts, gigawatts, which is 1,000 megawatts, or I think we're up to 1 billion watts. Is that right? 333. I think that's right.
I think so.
And then we get up to terawatts and more than that. When we are, just for some back of the envelope math here for consumption, like a refrigerator is a very common device that people have in their homes that pulls something like a fifth of a kilowatt or so. And it's a major household load because it's always on all the time, right? You got to keep your food cool. So
A fifth of
when
a
you think
kilowatt
about
over what time period?
fifth of a kilowatt, period, but it's always running, right? So
Okay.
another back of the envelope
Envelope
math
math
here.
here.
If you think about, give me a second here.
Absolutely.
Have a little cheat sheet here on different energy production that I think about myself, right? So if you think about 1 unit of time for like for example a meg 1 megawatt hour or 1 kilowatt hour, right? 1 unit of production. If you think about over the course of a year, if that's going all the time, then you can multiply it by about 1,000. So 1 megawatt hour going continuously is about a gigawatt hour per year, a gigawatt hour per year. So over the course of a household, when you add up all the different devices they have, you're looking at about 1 or 2 kilowatts. Depends on the household, obviously. In an apartment building, it's going to be a little lower because there's a lot of insulation, and you got some of these economies of scale. So you might have only 0.8 kilowatts, something like that, but you can have higher than that as well. And that gets us up to about 10-ish megawatt hours per year. So just some math there. When we think about a data center, we're looking at something more like 10 the smallest data center, medium-sized data center, we're looking at like maybe 10 megawatts, continuous pull, right, for about 80 gigawatt hours per year, up to one of these hyperscalers that could be 10 times that size, or about 100 megawatt hours, which would get us to coming up on 800 gigawatt hours, or up to a trillion, sorry, a terawatt hour per year of pull. When we compare that to household use, we're coming up on the size of a small city, or tens or hundreds of thousands of homes. So some a significant pull when we add these new data centers, and we're adding a lot of them,
A
right?
lot of them, right? So, and so, like,
A
one of
lot
these
of them.
big data centers, right, that we have, here out here in Ashburn, Loudoun County, whatever, or some out west. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't matter where they are. On an annual basis, they're pulling the same amount of power as, say, Richmond, ish.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that's why I this is part of why I talk about the orders of magnitude, right? So ish. It could be, twice as much, could be half as much, but it's not 10 times as much. And so when we're thinking about these kinds of physics concepts, we need to be on an order of magnitude. So you're about right. Yeah.
And then obviously it's cert like that, like the internet doesn't work without these. This is the repository for all of the internet, and then the pipes running through them, so. And then how does,
Yeah, I would. I mean, a lot of these data centers being built out aren't necessarily needed for just internet traffic, but a lot of them are being built for new large language model training, and stuff like that. I don't. I think the internet is working fine, or especially, if we didn't all use as many calls to ChatGPT or whatever, we wouldn't need all these data centers. They're important, but it's not like the entire internet's gonna go down if we don't keep on building them.
Well, yeah, I mean, but the internet doesn't function without any of them, is that right?
Without any of them, sure.
Yeah, if there were no data set like this, so like the, but this like this is the infrastructure that supports our modern world, right? It's like that's
Exactly. Yeah.
right.
Totally.
And so now you have, and I don't even know how many data centers are out in Ashburn. Somebody's counted them, or out in Loudoun, somebody's counted them, but I haven't. And there's a lot of them. So every single one of those big buildings you see, every massive data center, the large ones, are every single one of them is using the same amount of power as a small city.
Yeah, that's about right. Different some of them we think about several buildings together. You could have it's not going to be a 10x difference, right? But you could have between 100 megawatts or 200 megawatts, right? It's going to be that kind of a difference.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so why specifically when we talk about AI data centers, why did they require so much power? And what components within it are pulling the most?
Yeah, that's a good question. So GPUs are the biggest thing. They're pulling a lot of power. The fact that they're going all the time, and pulling energy all the time to do these big training runs or whatever, that's causing a lot of the pull. A lot of it is just the heat that's created. 30 to 40% of the total power is just from cooling, just from removing heat from the different clusters. So pumping all this cold water around, taking in the heat from those GPU clusters, pumping it back, and then releasing the extra the heat out of that water and turning back again. These are some of the bigger reasons for it, but they're also just heat, like tons of electrical components, right? There's just the scale is part of it as well.
There's some big ones. GPUs pull a lot of power, cooling, because computers, obviously, for the, I mean, I would assume most people know computers run faster when they're cold, which is why when you look at like high performance computing, they're, super cold. And also, around quantum, right? Most of a quantum computer is cooling, right?
Yeah, exactly. So when we think about a quantum computer, much less electricity. There is some electricity pull, of course, but much less pull than one of these AI data centers that's being built out. I don't have the specifics on amount of energy that a quantum computer uses, but a lot of the energy used is to cool it down to operating temperatures, and then once it's there, it can operate relatively easily at that steady state. The difference here is quantum computers need to be cold, but they don't generate a lot of heat. Whereas at least in the quantum part, right? So you have the quantum computer itself, and then it's connected to classical computers, our CPUs and GPUs, to interface with it, to send programs into it to run. We also have this idea of quantum-centric supercomputing. So quantum computers and classical computers working together to run an algorithm, to do some sort of hybrid algorithm. So you have a part of a training, a part of a run on a quantum computer. They send something to an AI computer. It does some sort of a pruning and sends that variable back. And then you kind of go back and forth until you hit this kind of steady state when it turns off. So lots of different parts in there. But when we think about cooling quantum computers, two things that are required, at least for IBM's quantum computers, they need to be cold enough to achieve superconducting, which we get down at about 4 Kelvin. Now, for quick lesson on temperatures, right? So we've got Fahrenheit and Celsius that we know pretty well. You can kind of convert. It's about to convert from Fahrenheit to Celsius. It's like a multiplying or dividing by 2 and adding or subtracting 30. It's not quite that, but it's about right. And then the difference between Celsius and Kelvin is on the order of about 260. Kelvin's just the same range as Celsius, but much lower. So 0 Kelvin is the measurement where there's no measurement, there's no movement of any atoms. So
Absolutely zero.
atoms are con exactly. Atoms are constantly vibrating and bumping against each other, and that's kind of how I'm sitting in this seat. The vibrations of the different atoms of my butt against the seat allows me to sit. Otherwise, there's so much gap, so much space between all these atoms that would fall through. So 0 Kelvin is where we get zero movement. And that's about something like -260-ish Celsius.
Which is colder than outer space, right?
Exactly. So our quantum computers operate at about 20 millikelvin, 0.02 Kelvin. So very, very close to absolute zero and much colder than anything you'd get outside in outer space. Because even in outer space, there's still some energy, some warmth, and some atoms moving around a little bit. It's very hard to achieve that absolute zero. The entropy of this universe just prevents that from happening, except when we really try to make it happen.
Absolutely. And what are some of the major, I mean, on quantum, since we're here now, Harry, like what are some of the major challenges to making quantum I don't want to say more useful, but more accessible, or kind of what are the major challenges we're looking to overcome right now to make it easier to use as, for researchers? Because I would assume this is not something that like an average person, the amount of compute that it has, most people don't really need that. But like we're talking like, massive industrial scale problems, correct?
Totally. Yeah. And it's helpful to think about the quantum computing it's at its core is a different paradigm of computing than classical. It's not that it's bigger, faster, stronger than classical computers. It's just going about it's doing a different kind of math. It's solving problems from a different angle. One common way we think about this or explain this simply, any analogy is going to be a little bit wrong, but some of these models are useful, as the saying goes. It's like if we're trying to use a classical computer to solve a maze, it might go in and take every right turn. It has an algorithm. Take every right turn until you hit a dead end. If you hit a dead end, move back a step, take a left, and then continue taking every right turn. So it's going to go and try to go through every different iteration of the maze. And at some point, it's going to find its way out the other end or to the center and to the prize. But it's going to take a long time. And we're going to have to brute force that. We don't have an efficient maze solving algorithm. But with quantum computing, it's basically like pouring water into the maze. So it's exploring it, the water spreads out evenly across all the paths, and you're basically able to hold all the different possibilities at once through the different quantum states. And then once you have that, once the water has filled the maze and you're able to hold all those ideas in the memory of the quantum computer once, then it can find kind of the you can add an ansatz or a paradigm kind of an equation to that you try to minimize you try to like minimize a Hamiltonian or something like that to find that lowest level of energy, and that will be in the end the solution to the maze. So it's just a different way of thinking about solving a problem than a classical computer. Now, some of the I mentioned before, some of the biggest use cases are around uncovering new kinds of materials, medicines, doing optimization problems, things like this. But to get to that, and we're already at what we call quantum utility, where quantum computers are just as good as classical computers at doing certain things. We're now trying to get to quantum advantage, where quantum computers become significantly better than classical computers at, again, doing certain tasks, solving certain kinds of math problems. And we measure that usually with being faster, doing it more cheaply, or being able to purely solve a problem that couldn't be solved otherwise. Sometimes we say like it would take all the atoms in the universe to build a computer big enough to solve one of these problems that a quantum computer can solve in the course of just a couple of hours. So the gap to getting there is meeting is intersecting between the skill or the scale of hardware and the ease or efficiency of the algorithms to solve some of these math problems. So we often show a chart from IBM Quantum showing that, okay, yep, we have from the bottom left, hardware continues to get better and better. We get improved a higher number of qubits, improved speed and quality of those qubits. So we're kind of expanding the capabilities of our computers. And then at the same time, in the upper right, the kind of the targets that we're trying to hit, the algorithms that we're trying to implement, those need to get easier to implement. So that space needs to pull down to be easier and easier. And then once we get those intersections, we'll see enterprise capable quantum computers solving enterprise challenges. So we're doing a lot of that research now already in material science, in medicine, in optimization, in all these different kinds of areas. And once we have, as we see more and more of that overlap, we'll be able to solve more and more of those algorithms and answer more and more of those challenges and problems that we see out in the world.
It's fantastic. Really appreciate the explanation. Really think I love the explanation of pouring the water into the maze and kind of visualizing that. And I mean, that also makes sense why it will render all cybersecurity methods presently used obsolete overnight, because like it's really where, when you put a password in, it's just like a key that unlocks the door. And instead of like with current computing, some of these attacks where they just put new passwords in over and over and over and over and over again, essentially what you're saying is that it would just put in all the passwords all at once.
Yeah, so
Kind of.
let's go into that a little bit, because when a lot of people think about quantum computing, the first thing that comes to mind is hacking encryption. So there's an algorithm called Shor's algorithm, developed by Peter Shor in 1994, saying, "Hey, I think there's a way if we could make a quantum computer and make it big enough, then we could, in theory, factor large numbers." And factoring numbers is of benefit to pure math and number theorists all over the place. It just also happens to be the technology that is behind encrypting a lot of our passwords and transactions that occur every day, millions of times per day over the web. That right now is a, we don't have an efficient algorithm for factoring large numbers using classical computers. It could be any day now that somebody could come up with an algorithm for this. It's been decades, nearly a century, that nobody has come up with something like this. So we don't think that this will happen, but we do have an algorithm now that, in theory, could factor a large number. And if implemented on a cryptographically relevant or large enough, strong enough quantum computer, then you could implement Shor's algorithm and break asymmetric public key encryption such as RSA. To do this, you encryption uses these large prime numbers, we would be able to find those large prime numbers using Shor's algorithm a lot more easily. So it's basically, yes, what you're saying, trying all the passwords at once isn't too far off. I think that pretty well shows the concern. It's like if you're given a key and you can factor it immediately, then that's basically the concern. Now we're seeing issues already coming. There's this concept of harvest now, decrypt later, where we're seeing some databases, like I think there was a famous hack sometime in the last year or so, or maybe it was 2 years ago, of some State Department records, US State Department records, getting hacked by some sort of actor out of, we think, China. With no direct visibility or pathway that we could see towards decrypting it. They just took the encrypted data. So it could be that when we take when we that that these actors are taking data and storing it, harvesting it now, until there's a cryptographically relevant quantum computer that they can implement algorithms like Shor's on. So they can decrypt it then. So we have to think about things like things that are hard to change, right? So passwords are pretty easy to change, but for example, having to issue a new social security number to everybody in the United States, that would take some time, right? Changing or even like biometrics, changing my eye color, my iris, I'm probably not going to do that over the course of my lifetime. So this data, my eye, is going to be sensitive information for me for hope the next 70 years, if I live that long. We need to implement these new kinds of algorithms, new kinds of encryption standards that are kind of quantum safe as soon as possible, so we can protect the data that resides in all these different databases, and that's flowing through transactions all the time.
Absolutely. And bringing this back to energy and power, how could we
Sure.
use quantum to optimize the power grid, right? Because it's clearly, as you said, there's three different grids now. Data centers are using every data center is using about like the large ones are using about the same amount of power as like a Richmond or a Spokane, Washington, or any of these, mid-sized cities. How like with quantum and that level of compute, how could we use that to like solve some of the efficiency problems around electricity and power?
Totally. So, a lot of the use cases I said around material science and around optimization. So a big one is figuring out doing some optimization questions to see how we can, I don't know, how we can make the grid itself run more effectively. We're doing some work, some research right now with a couple of EV operators to try to figure out how to optimize EV connections to the grid, optimizing charging, things like that. I already spoke previously about the different kinds of material science applications. So we haven't talked about it at all, but one thing to make the grid a lot more resilient is to add batteries to it. So this would allow a reservoir of electrons to be stored somewhere. So we don't have to be constantly making the energy that's being used in exactly that millisecond. We can charge a battery over time, and then also dispatch it over time and use that charge to for the various uses that we have every day. So having and we're building some new batteries and attaching them to the grid. There's a use both at the utility itself on the at the renewable site or at the power generation site to allow more flexibility, to allow a decreased cost with especially as I mentioned with these renewables having inconsistent power generation rates. Having a battery there allows better matching of the energy that you're creating to the demands of the grid. And we're seeing this. I should take just a minute to illustrate the big concern with matching. We see this especially in California, where the peak of solar is in the middle of the day when the sun's hottest, high it's highest in the sky. But that's not when people are using the most electricity. When people start using the most electricity is around 5, 6 p.m. They get
Right,
back
they get
from
home.
work. They start turning on the air conditioning or their heaters, depending on the time of year. They turn on their stoves and start cooking, right? Like these are all big energy sucks. And so it would be easier to match this demand to supply if we had the peaks match up, but we don't. So adding batteries to power generation would allow us to even that demand supply out a little bit more over time. Adding batteries to consumers would allow more resiliency to the consumer. So if we have a blackout, then you could run off of your battery for a little bit, right? So, and if you
Is it better
have
to
your
have
own,
like batteries at everybody's home or like have centralized massive batteries? What I mean, I don't know what's be more efficient.
right? I think both have some merit. And if we had a better grid system in general, transmission and distribution lines, then we wouldn't necessarily need both. But in lieu of updating all these lines, it is nice to have both sides so that you have the optimal resiliency. Now, there are costs associated with it, but using things like quantum computing, we might be able to uncover new designs for batteries to make them store more energy more easily and efficiently, charge and dispatch energy over time, make them cheaper, things like that, so that we can add more more batteries to the grid and make this all more resilient. Now, there are still issues with getting all of the metals, rare earth metals, and all the supply chain concerns with battery production. There are always like regulations and concerns with some of these, the logistics of adding new batteries to the grid, engineering challenges and construction challenges and things like that. But this is one hope for improving operations of the grid.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and I would assume that we can also use quantum and AI together to optimize a lot of it, in addition to that. But do you actually know how much electricity is used by data centers in this country, like as a percentage of overall generation?
Sure. It's hard to count or track the number of data centers or their power because they're each of them is registered under different companies, and so there are different broad shell com broad different fields of shell companies that are running these. Business Insider actually did a really good assessment about a month ago, I think, of the build out of new data centers, new AI data centers, and they're all like registered under different names. I think like there was one plant registered under this Magellan Energy or Magellan company, and through tracking and all the different through all the paperwork, they found that it was owned by Google. So it's hard to track all of the data centers out there.
Well, that's scary,
So
but here to there.
I don't have a number on the total build out, but we are having a little bit of trouble keeping up with the amount of growth that we're seeing on the grid. We
Absolutely.
can at least say that.
Yeah, and how, like, when you think about AI, like, consumption of power for AI, how much energy does it require to train a model versus, running a model? And like, essentially, is it more, how much more expensive is it to train a model versus just like use it?
Sure. So training a model is much more time intensive, but it's just one time. It's going to be a big intensive job using weeks or months, thousands of GPUs. But inference is going to, in the long term, it's going to be the thing that runs that we do most of the time, right? So it's about, I think, 80 to 90% of the energy total that's being used for training new models. But we'll also see as these models become more and more widespread across industry that people will be using inference more and more, and that number might increase as well.
Absolutely. No, and that makes a lot of sense. And are there what are some of the proposed solutions out there around meeting this demand without doing like a complete power grid overhaul?
As you said already, the one big solution is to connect new generation to the grid or to a microgrid right near the data center, instead of having to rely on the grid itself. So Microsoft is doing that, and I think a lot of these big tech companies and hyperscalers are hoping for a lot of build out of nuclear. You see a lot of support for nuclear power because it's so consistent, and because we've had some success there. Big regulatory challenges. That's one of the biggest costs of deploying new nuclear. But there's a lot of hope there. But just adding new generation on site can satisfy the needs of some of these data centers. or even make them net generators of power during some points of the day, right? So depending on when the training runs are happening or when people are inferencing, probably when people are awake, right? Then the needs, the demands are higher those times. And then and off times, the wind actually blows stronger in general at nighttime. So there might be some times that we're actually adding energy back to the grid, depending on the size of the energy generation attached to these to the data centers.
Yeah, and I'm personally a proponent of nuclear power. I think that when you look at the most environmentally friendly ways that we have to generate electricity, consistently generate electricity at scale, I think nuclear is the best we have right now. Until somebody solves, like fusion power, reliably, things, where like the next, let's just say the next level, or next order of magnitude up from power generation, right?
Totally.
But nuclear is awesome to me. You just gotta take care of the spent fuel rods.
Right. And yeah, I think nuclear is a good potential. I think solar plus batteries is another great potential possibility. And just one that we've seen a lot more cost decreases over the last decade or so. We've seen huge decreases to solar, something on the order of 90% decreases in cost. And we're seeing similar kinds of learning improvements on batteries because they're small and modular. So whereas with these nuclear sites, the learning curves aren't quite as favorable. So they probably, in my opinion, they won't drop as quickly as solar and as batteries will. So I'm thinking in the long term, solar plus batteries will probably be a better long term option, especially with recycled batteries. There's a couple companies that are doing some really interesting things now with second life batteries. You take an EV can only run for you only want an EV to run until the battery is at 80% of its capacity. Well, then you still have 80% capacity left. So there's this company, Redwood Materials, that's doing some really good work stringing together EV batteries, essentially, hundreds or thousands of them, to make that a new energy storage site alongside renewable energy. And then you don't have any sort of concerns with fuel or storing spent rods, anything like that. So that could also be a good solution. I would also say to improve the efficiency of some of these data centers, trying to use analytics to consume energy when it's the cheapest, right? So in the middle of the day when the sun's shining the brightest, if you can wait and match that supply to demand, then that's going to improve your efficiency as well.
Yeah,
So
no.
some things we can do.
Yeah, no, and that makes sense. And I think that like I love solar as well. I think that it's a crucial step to moving us off of a linear supply chain as it relates to energy generation. But I question for you that I didn't prepare you for. Do you know much about like solar panels in orbit and using them to generate because the sun is a lot more powerful outside of the atmosphere. Is that a viable generation technique?
I don't think it is now. It's just a matter of what kind of breakthroughs we have in the future. I don't know a lot about it, but let's speculate a little bit. So if we have the sun is a lot brighter the closer you get, right? So if we have solar panels in space, or I think there's also some ideas about solar mirrors to kind of direct the energy from space, maybe down to the Earth or something like that. But if you can generate energy in space, then you need to get it back down. So then we rely a lot on the cost to either ship batteries back and forth, or Nikola Tesla had this idea of wireless energy. Same kind of the idea of like a MagSafe charging on your phone, but like a much further scale. So if SpaceX can keep on decreasing the cost of per kilogram of launches, then we might see that as a viable alternative as well. It's definitely going to be a good alternative for doing things out in space. So running things like asteroid mining, operations on the ISS, things like that. And maybe you have, I don't know, maybe you have a data center out in space. There's already some talk of saying, well, look, we've got there's a lot of promise for offshore wind, and so I'm interested in that. And so some people are talking about either having data centers out floating in the middle of the ocean where there's no regulations, no NIMBYism out there, having societies out floating in the middle of the ocean. Some of these tech utopian types are talking about this kind of thing. So you could have the same kind of thing out in space. Societies or teams out there, maybe even it wouldn't be too hard to SSH into a computer that's in orbit, right? It'd just be really hard to get out there to do maintenance on it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it would bring cooling costs down.
It certainly would. Yep, that's true.
No, and I think a lot of these things are fascinating, and I'm also a big proponent of moving to a multi-planet civilization. I think that that'd be a huge step for us as a species, right? If we can manage to do it without killing ourselves, in the process, and can kind of, I forget the name of the, was it the Great Filter, where every single society that is ever that ha, it has the us as well, but every single, if there are other, sentient beings out in the universe, every single society has to go through the period where you have, and we're here now, and we've been here since the 40s, you have the ability to kill yourselves, right? And you have to figure out how do you manage that kind of weaponry, without killing ourselves. And I think the administration just said they're going to restart nuclear tests for the first time since like the early 90s, which is always fun. It'll be super interesting to see if we can make it through that. I'd like to hope, I think we can, and move towards, the next, phase of in society, which would be cool. But I think that a massive step in that is going to be being able to support, multiplanetary civilization. And I also think that a lot of the environmental challenges that we're facing here, in over the next, let's call it, century, the technology that we would develop to have to start to, say, terraform a place like Mars, would we could use that same technology to solve a lot of the environmental challenges that we have here in this planet that we have been creating for the last, call it since 1851 when the first oil well, or 1851, 52, 53 when the first oil well was dug. And I'm also very curious about, you think about, the Industrial Revolution ran on coal. The last 150 years, the vehicular revolution is run on oil, and I'm very curious what the next, like, power generation is, because, what is the next step, for us? Because, like, another huge reason I'm a big proponent of a lot of this is of moving away from fossil fuels, which are, let's be clear, we're burning dead animals and dead plants that have been on the earth for millions of years. And the reason there is no oil in the Appalachian Mountain Range, is because the range itself predates fossils. Which is just fascinating to me. It's why there are no animal there were no animals there when they were the biggest mountains in the world. So, but when you think about energy density, none of that is, like, we can't use oil to fly around the galaxy or around our solar system, because there is no more oil here, right? So we have to figure out how can we create, generate energy in a more space efficient way, at a higher rate and a higher level, to really move to the next, to really, be able to go out and, like, solve some of these challenges.
Totally. Yeah. So having nuclear reactors on a ship, yeah, things like that, right? I think for if you have to move around in space without access to renewable energy, you're doing self-propulsion, having some sort of reactor on your ship could be a solution. I mean, the Chinese are doing a lot of great work with thorium reactors. That's in theory a self-perpetuating fuel source. Like we mentioned before, cold fusion creates rather than destroys matter. So yeah, who knows what kind of energy we'll be using in the future to propel ourselves. But it probably would be we're seeing really efficient hybrid vehicles, right? So maybe we'd see something like a small nuclear, like we have on subs, right? A small nuclear power plant to spin a battery or an electric system that then powers the ship. And yeah, who knows, we may not even be on nuclear. It could be gravity waves or something that we're using as energy. Yeah, really the sky is the limit, right? For our spacefaring future and society.
Absolutely.
There's also you're talking about Mars. There's some really interesting, I mean, it's continuous research going on there. But Perseverance recently discovered some new dry riverbeds in the Jezero crater. I was looking up some of the stuff that while you were talking before that I saw John Green talking about on YouTube. That was interesting to me. So there more and more possibility of having water on Mars, and therefore potentially maybe if not life now, then maybe there had previously been life, and maybe it might make it easier for us to move there and use that as another jumping off point to explore the universe.
Super cool, man. And it'll be really interesting to see how we kind of navigate all this and and are able to work through like but we have to work through the lot of challenges here around data, AI and specifically like the power generation associated with it, because it is very, very, very power intensive, power hungry, and as you know, as we've been talking about for the last hour or so, like we're not ready from a infrastructure perspective to really support that. We need to either like look at small cell nuclear or other ways to generate. And then I would assume that we can use AI to help overcome some of the challenges to integrate more of the renewables in, adding batteries, and more batteries and going from there, man. It's super, super cool. And I really appreciate it. Go ahead.
Thank you for having me on. Yeah, I think the two big parallel challenges we have are either getting to some sort of AI superintelligence and or getting to free abundant energy, clean energy, right? Whoever can get to that first will probably also then solve the other problem pretty soon after that. So the more that we can do to be energy independent in the US, and as well as continuing down the AI road to try to find really strong AI that we can control and be and have aligned with our interests, the better, I think.
Absolutely. Really appreciate it, Harry. Thank you so much for coming on, man. I've really, really enjoyed the conversation. I learned a lot, especially about how the grid is set up. And yeah, dude, this has been a lot of fun. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for the time, Nick. It's been really
Yeah,
great.
everybody, thanks for listening to Robots and Red Tape. I hope you're having a great day.